On this episode of the Endurance Hour podcast, cupping, what is it when it comes to recovery and massage, transition tips and tricks, having bike fit issues, do your feet get numb, how's your back feel, we'll go into detail on that, how fueling differs based on the distance you race, and the new discount codes and products for 2022. The Endurance Hour podcast starts right now.
Are you listening? Damn.
So we finish every podcast by saying, have a great week of training, racing, or recovery. And we're going to start off this podcast with recovery and something both Wendy and I have recently experienced. And I jokingly told her, I have a new PR. I've had 38 cups on my back after and during one of my recent massage therapy sessions. And she herself recently had some cupping done. And I want to get your initial spontaneous reaction to what it was like for you, and then we'll explain what is cupping, it's a form of massage therapy, but what was your experience, Wendy?
I actually thought it was a great experience. So my massage therapist, she's new, I went to her for the first time, and while she worked on one leg, she would, you know, do the traditional, you know, deep tissue massage. When she went to the next leg, she put cups on the leg while she was working my other leg. And she kind of did that with all body parts. You know, she worked my upper back, she'd be cupping my lower back, and then she would cup my upper back while she worked on my lower back. And so I felt like I was getting the benefit of the actual massage hands-on as well as the cupping. And at first, especially my first quad, putting the cups on was very painful and uncomfortable, like to the point where I was a little bit tense. And then once I relaxed, throughout, you know, the duration of the cups on my quad, I actually felt really good. And when she took them off, it was just like, you know, kind of this sense of, I don't really understand what it does from a recovery standpoint because I've never had it done, but I just knew it felt really good. And the day after my massage, I'm not really generally a massage person, but the day after this particular massage, I felt incredible. And so I think it had to do with maybe the new technique with the cupping. And so I thought it was pretty cool.
And this is kind of in preparation for some ultra runs that you're going to be doing or have been doing?
Yeah. So I've been doing a lot of uphills and downhills. So the quads primarily have been taking a lot of tension and stress, especially both quads on my lateral sides of my body have been taking a lot of stress. So I now that I found this massage person that I really liked, really relatable, I think I'm going to get more regular treatments as I prepare for my event in 2 months.
And what are the other kind of recovery techniques or things that you have used in the past? For example, compression sleeves or pants?
You know, long ago, we're talking 2008, I remember one of my friends gifted me a pair of Skins compression tights. And I wore those all the time. They were very comfortable. I really didn't have a sense of what they were doing from a recovery standpoint, but that was actually my first pair of recovery tights. I don't use calf sleeves. I don't do anything else other than those tights. Mm-hmm. And I tend to be someone who actually just wears tights in general as my everyday wear apparel. And I also use, recently, about 2 years ago, I got one of those Hypervolt guns. It's like a percussion Theragun, except mine's a Hypervolt. And my massage therapist last week actually used one of those on me as well. That I use, and I really believe that that's kept my calves healthy the past 2 years, especially as I've gotten into more running volume and more trail running. Keeping my calves healthy has been important to me because that's usually, if I get an injury, it's usually lower body related. And then I think I'm really good with pre, during, and post workout recovery and hydration. I think that really enhances just the overall, you know, day to day, week to week, month to month. Mm-hmm. In general, recovery is your nutrition. And I also try to get a fair amount of sleep if I can at night. Because I believe if you're not getting the sleep or the quality nutrition, nothing else matters. That has to come first. And then I think everything else, such as massage, compression, the Hypervolt, and all other modalities that people use, will only enhance recovery. I don't think they're a replacement for good sleep and quality nutrition.
Yeah, and hydration, absolutely. The rolling sticks, the foam rollers, those kind of things are also things that people use that are inexpensive and you can do it whenever you want. Mm-hmm. So this cupping is a form of massage therapy which decompresses soft tissue using vacuum suction, and unlike other forms of massage that compresses soft tissue. So during cupping, the cup generally sucks to your skin and lifts underlying soft tissue into the cup. It looks like a big zit, actually. I mean, if you were to zoom in on it, it's a huge, it looks like a big zit. It's pulling it up, and you'll have a hickey afterwards. They say when it comes to how it feels, it's very relaxing and generally not painful. The sensation that is experienced is the pulling of the skin as the cup is moved into a rolling fashion. Redness or the feeling of warmth is usually experienced after the release of the cup due to the increased blood flow to the area. And I think it's one of those things. That's why it gets so red. It gets a little itchy afterwards, as I experienced yesterday. And I don't know if I had 38 cups on my back yesterday.
That's
from
a
my
lot.
Neck down to my just below my waistline.
Uh-huh.
But it was, I asked for it because I had a tough swim the day before. And anyone can really benefit from this stuff. It is used to treat a lack of mobility, tight muscles, scars, and many diagnoses like headaches, tendonitis, bursitis, plantar fasciitis, fibromyalgia, and the release of trigger points. And so here are the benefits of cupping. Release scar tissue and facial adhesions, reduce painful trigger points, improve circulation, blood and lymph circulation, relieve pain, promote mobility and range of motion, improve mature scars, and decrease toxins. And I have used them on my back and my legs. There's some areas that are on my IT band. I don't know if I've had it on my calves so much, but last year when I was trying to figure out why my knee was hurting before I found out that I had I had a scar tissue in my knee that needed to be trimmed out. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, like, why is my knee hurting? And some of this was making my knee feel good the next day, but obviously it was never going to fix it until mm-hmm. I found out later. But I usually have immediate results of feeling better after the cupping within the massage therapy.
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like extra money. It's just, at least it hasn't been. There's been no extra charge. It's just part of the massage. Like, hey, do you need it this time? Or let's try a couple over here. One of the massage people I went to, who's now moved out of the area, so I can't go to her anymore, would just use the cup and suction, but then roll the cup around as a form mm-hmm. of massage. So it's pulling up the skin as it goes, and it felt great. And it's somewhat relaxing. After a while, it just becomes kind of a little numb. You forget about it after it's on there. If you want to know what it looks like, think of Michael Phelps when he was in the Olympics and he had all those red dots on his back. That's what it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, that's funny because that's what I thought of. Am I going to look like Michael Phelps? And when I got home and I saw the marks, I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah, it really does do that to you.
And those marks can last up to a week. And you'll have to talk to your own massage therapist on what the darkness means, because some spots are darker than others. Mm-hmm. And, if it gets purple immediately, she says that's a problem area. If it's not so purplish, then, that's not an area that needed so much. But, it's pulling up the blood and bringing circulation. And that's what you can need that, and it feels good afterwards.
Yeah.
And I use the compression, too, after workouts, and I've had good success with the specific skins, compression, leggings after mm-hmm. runs and stuff. And I always feel great after it. So when I say have a good week of racing, training, or recovery, maybe think about that the next time you're thinking about recovery. On to our questions. Transition tips and tricks. This is from Linda, and she's going to be doing her first sprint and Olympic this summer. So congratulations to you. And she says, any favorite transition tricks or advice from you two? First, Wendy, what do you think?
So when it comes to transition, I had this conversation with an athlete just last week. When it comes to transitions, I never practiced them. My transitions back in the day, and again, I started in 1992. My transitions were my races. I used to race sprints and Olympics almost every weekend the first year after my very first sprint. Mm-hmm. And those are my transition workouts, if you wanted to call them that. Those are my brick workouts. I never did a bike run in training or a swim bike in training. I never did any of that. And I always said, if I ever lose a race because someone has a faster transition time than me, then I need to start focusing on transitions. And actually in 2004, it was age group nationals, and I missed out on maybe like the third place overall. I was a faster swimmer, faster biker, faster runner, but the girl just beat me by 12 seconds, and she beat me because my transitions were slow. So then I'm like, okay, I need to start focusing on actually being a little bit more mindful and picking up the pace in transition. So it is definitely what makes triathlon triathlon, is those transitions from swim to bike and bike to run. And so I think the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, try to keep it simple. I did a video, I believe it was in 2021, we posted triathlon then and now, and I went through examples of how I used to transition. You know, I used to wash my feet, I used to sit on a bucket, I used to just kind of lollygag while I was doing it, and then how that has changed now, where now, you know, you have one outfit that you're wearing. I'm not putting on shorts, I'm not putting on t-shirts in transition. So I keep it really simple. It's best to go watch an event or watch one on TV and see what other people are doing. But I want to first talk about the space of transition. I like to fold up a towel and keep that as my space. I lay out my I have different shoes for cycling and running. So I'll lay out my cycling shoes, my running shoes. I always put socks on top of my running shoes. Sometimes I wear them, sometimes I don't. I put my helmet on my bike. I put my glasses in my helmet, and I put my racing belt and bib number on top of my helmet because I put that on for the bike. And that's it. I keep it very simple. So you don't want to like get caught up into bringing too much of your gear in transition. And then the second thing is to definitely practice what you're going to do. I've been racing so much that it's very much a habit of I put on my glasses, my helmet, sometimes I'm putting on my shoes while I'm putting on my glasses and helmet, if I can multitask like that. And I'm just kind of always going through it in my mind. I'm visualizing what I'm going to do just because I have the experience and I know what I'm going to do. So definitely make sure whatever you decide you're going to do is you know ahead of time by practicing what you're going to do race day, what you're going to wear, if you're going to have any nutrition, and if you have separate cycling shoes, separate running shoes, if you're going to wear socks or go sockless, if you're going to put your bib number on a race belt or put your bib number on your outfit, if you're going to wear a wetsuit, if you're not going to wear a wetsuit, there's definitely a lot of things to consider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely visualizing what it's going to be like once you get out of the water into your first transition of what the steps are. And that's what you do when you're in transition, is you get pre-race. It's like, okay, what would be the first thing I do? Okay, I'm going to come over here. I need to wipe my feet off from, you know, pulling the wetsuit off if you're in a wetsuit. Wipe my feet off, get the thing off, set it aside. What's the first thing goes on? The helmet. Get the helmet on. And sometimes you can put your sunglasses on your race kit, like on your around your neck. For me, I wear my race bib in the water. I just crumple it up and roll it underneath my swim outfit in some way, so that's one less thing. But if you don't want to, you know, you're mostly only required, almost always required to have it on the run. But if you don't, and you don't have to wear it on the bike during the run, just carry it with you until you put it on. Or if you have it already strapped, put it over your head like you're putting on a shirt, you know, or put it over your shoulder, something to hang on to it. That way you can not be in transition putting it on. You can run with it in your hand. Same with your goggles. I'm not your goggles, your sunglasses or your cap. Or your visor. You can run with that stuff. You don't have to put it on in transition. Mm-hmm. You just got to get out of transition. But I think that the simplicity of what you're saying is important. And the less you have to think in transition, the faster you'll be. So everything needs to be where it is. And when you walk up, it's muscle memory. It's like, okay, here's the order. There's the helmet. Shoes either on the bike or you put them on. And do you put socks on during the bike? Think about that ahead of time. Are you going to wear socks or not? Same thing with the run. Do you want to put, I put powder in my shoes, both my shoes, because my feet are usually wet, or if they're sweaty, I want them to be a little bit drier for the run. And I'll put powder in my socks on the run so that I have dry socks to absorb any moisture as well. And then just a very clean, minimal transition. Have everything there.
Yeah, and another thing I wanted to add, because you said, are your shoes going to be on your pedals? I don't recommend that, especially for your first one.
Not for your first.
and if you are going to have your shoes and your pedals, usually people clip them or have that ready. They use various rubber bands.
Yeah.
Watch people doing it, because even the pros could wipe out because, you know, they're running their bike out of transition, or they're running their bike to the mount line and they have their shoes clipped in, but for some reason the rubber band becomes undone, and then they end up tripping because their shoe, as they're running their bike out, hits the ground and their shoe falls off. So it's definitely a technique that, doing the sport for 30 years, I will never do that technique because I've seen too many athletes wipe out doing that. But it's definitely something to consider. And also, are you going to put your shoes on and run through transition to the mount line with your shoes on? Or are you going to carry your shoes and run to the mount line in bare feet and then put your shoes on at the mount line? I've done that both ways, depending on how long I have to run through transition to get to that mount line. And I think it's really important to also note and remember, your helmet must be fastened around your neck before you hop on your bike. So get in the habit of putting your helmet on and clipping the strap before you do anything else, because that's going to be a disqualification if they see you leaving on your bike without that helmet strapped or clipped. It's either disqualification or penalty.
Yeah, the running through transition with your shoes on is really challenging because it's not a flat surface under your foot. You know, there's one here in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, in the park where it's all grassy, so it's not as hard to get a grip in transition when you're running in the grass. But once you get onto the sidewalk or the pavement, it gets really tricky if they don't allow you to put your shoes on your bike or clip on your bike. And then once you get to the stage where you're comfortable with the shoes on the bike and you can run with the bike, it's a decision. Do I jump on the bike while it's rolling, or do I take the time? I think take the time just to put your foot on top of the shoe. And there's another thing right there. Do you try to put your shoes on right then and there, or do you start spinning, which I'll do just to get out on the course, spin, and then once you get up to speed, no one's around you, put one foot in at a time, and then that just takes practice. And so if you're around your house, like, what's it like to step on top of shoes and try to Velcro your shoes on while you're spinning? You know, it takes a little time and coordination to do that. And the best can do it pretty quick and you wouldn't even notice it.
Right. And then just also note, if this, you know, Linda said it was, I think her name was Linda, said it was her first, she was doing her first sprint, Olympic.
Yep.
She may not even have clipless pedals and shoes. She may be riding her bike in the shoes she plans to run in, which again is going to make for an even quicker transition to be able to do that. So again, the bottom line is, whatever you decide to do, watch what other people are doing and then spend some time practicing.
Yeah, there's also, what about some nutrition tricks and advice in transition?
Well, again, back in the day, I used to have power bars and power gels mounted on the top tube of my bike. And so all my nutrition was on my bike. It was less on my body and mostly on my bike. And that's definitely changed with technology. And now they have bento boxes, and now they have tri kits that have pockets, or you may wear a cycling jersey that has pockets. I normally have my nutrition in my helmet so I don't forget it. So that's another thing I'll do. I'll put my glasses on, grab my nutrition. Maybe I'll put it up my short pants, pant short leg, whatever you want to call it. Or I'll actually put it down my sports bra, so it's on my body now. Less of a chance of me losing it if it's on my bike. If you go over a bump or something happens that it ends up falling off your bike, well, then it's gone.
Yeah.
And just to note, if anything does fall off your bike and an official sees that and you don't pick it up, that's considered abandoned equipment and you're going to get a penalty. So just going back to the rule books, if you are doing your first event out there and you're listening to this, make sure you read the rule books, USA Triathlon rule books, because there are some things that are not very obvious that could cause you to get a penalty, such as littering or abandoned equipment. I see it all the time.
I've never seen anybody get a penalty for anything. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not around. I'm just not around long enough just to see it. And I'm not to say I'm just not there.
Yeah, I guess I don't see it. I don't see it, but I hear about it. Oh, okay. I hear that it's a possibility. And yeah. So, you know, it's always good to just read the rule book or skim it or go to the pre-race meeting. And like I said, you know, your first race, take your time, gather your bearings, you know, make sure you don't forget anything, use it as an experience to learn from, and then make adjustments as you move forward with more training and more racing.
And for Linda, this being her first sprint and Olympic, there's not going to be a lot of nutrition necessary. I wouldn't load up your bike with 3 water bottles ever. Seriously, I just would never do 3. I mean, I have in the past, but I don't need that. Unless one's always going to be, for me, always going to be a nutrition bottle. It's going to be liquid uh-huh. with some sort of nutrition in it for calories. Other one will be just a water bottle. And then everything else is available on the course for the longer mm-hmm. races. But for a sprint, maybe take a swig of water before you go on the bike. And after that, just one water bottle and maybe one gel on the bike. And after that, maybe a gel or two for an Olympic distance. But yeah. It shouldn't be a lot for those two when it comes to what you need to bring with you. And something will be on the course, definitely should be on the course for the Olympic. On the run, mm-hmm. for sure on the run.
Right.
Yeah. And we'll get to
a lot of sprints will have one aid station halfway through the run. So like a mile and a half into the run, I think they'll have one aid station.
Yeah. But never really on a bike for us, not for a sprint.
Not for a sprint. It's usually just carry your own water bottle with either water or a hydration, like
same
a Gatorade or something.
Bike. I can't recall any Olympics with aid stations, but depends on how many loops or what the course is.
Yeah. You know, and someone doing an Olympic, a beginner, someone doing an Olympic could be out there for 4 or 5 hours still. So they're going to need some more nutrition rather than someone like me who's going to be out on the course for like 2.5 hours or someone like you.
Yeah. Yep. We have another nutrition question coming up. This one from Letty. And she posted the bike fit question on our last podcast. And so she says here, I just got a bike fit. And I think some of us have been there before. And after the first ride on my new fit, my feet felt numb. My back ached, and I was moving so much on my saddle. This is after the bike fit. Where should I be sitting on the saddle when I ride? When you want to address the numb feet and the back before we get to the saddle?
Yeah, so I followed up with her, and there were a lot of changes. I mean, I believe they moved the saddle down 3 centimeters. Moving the saddle down a couple millimeters is a big difference. So 3 centimeters is a lot. That's actually going to be a reason where your positions, you're going to have to adjust to the new position. Now, she did not get aero bars. I believe last week we talked about her bike fit person recommended her not to get aero bars because it's not a flat course. And so I was curious about her lower back because she's usually when you go from an upright position to an aero position, that does take some time and some experience to get your lower back acclimated to that new, you know, position. And so the saddle, now here's the saddle thing. I looked at her bike fit and the saddle, the nose of the saddle, I believe, was tilted down mm-hmm. more than she had it. So if the saddle's tilted down, this has happened to me. If it's tilted down too much, it's going to cause you to like kind of slide back and forth if it's not comfortable. And so I think I understand what she means. I think because the saddle nose was tilted down maybe a little bit too much, she's just kind of maybe sliding and just having, you know, difficulty getting comfortable sitting there. And so I sent her an article about sitting on her sits bones, because that's what I always hear after a bike fit, that you're trying to sit on your sits bones, which is the ischial tuberosity part of your sacrum pelvis area. And so hopefully that'll help. I'm not the expert on that, but hopefully that'll help her. And I suggested that she maybe get that nose tilted down or, you know, maybe adjusted, and definitely go back to the bike fit or give it another few rides, mm-hmm. but definitely go back to your bike fit person and explain what's going on. And maybe they can make a little bit more adjustments, because again, when you get a bike fit, you're normally in a stationary position on a trainer, not out in the real world. And it's going to be a little bit different feeling when you're getting a fit indoors stationary than when you're riding outside on various terrain or wind. And again, the best advice is to go back to the fit person and explain the issues. As far as the numb feet, that could be a shoe thing. Maybe she needs new shoes, but that could also be her cleat position. They went from the cleat position that was mostly on the higher end, you know, ball of her foot. They moved it down towards her heel. And so maybe just that pressure of the new cleat position on her bike is maybe pressing on a nerve. Mm-hmm. Or her shoes maybe have been just, you know, by chance, maybe her shoes were fitting a little bit too tight that day and causing some circulation issues. Usually any type of numbing that's occurring is generally a circulation issue.
Yes.
Or a nerve issue. So that's definitely something that's not supposed to happen that she needs to address.
You're saying about numb feet, and I'm thinking, okay, it has to be some sort of a nerve or it's too tight. And then I thought, then I recalled one of my races where it was the swim was super cold. It was like in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And my feet never warmed up mm-hmm. on the bike, and they were numb. And then when they started, quote, warming up, they were started tingling like little needles. It's mm-hmm. like, and they still felt that way on the run, the initial part of the run. It just so uncomfortable. And I know if you have numb feet and it's not a cold issue, it's something else, it just can be super frustrating. So there's a couple of things going on there with how you're sitting and the pressure around your feet. That's not a good thing. You don't want your feet to be numb. I think the lower back thing can just probably just be getting used to the position on the saddle. Yeah. And, you know, whatever your reach is on your, you said aero bars or no aero bars?
No aero bars.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a good question that definitely needs to be addressed with the person who did her bike fit.
Yeah. You probably wouldn't feel that. Would you feel that immediately during the bike fit? Maybe not, right?
The lower back?
The numb feet. Because you're not going to be on the bike for, you know, an hour during a bike fit spinning to feel
right,
the tightness.
Yeah. Wouldn't feel that initially with the bike fit. It's just something that happens. Like I said, I think the cleat position could be hitting some sort of nerve. Maybe she has like a neuroma that she didn't know about and now it's pinching the neuroma in her foot. Or maybe there's something in the sacrum area that's hitting a nerve and it's shooting down and it's related to her feet because it's all connected. And there's just, you know, a lot of different things going on. That's just so she knows that's not supposed to happen. The bike fit's supposed to make you more comfortable, maybe more aerodynamic, but more than the aerodynamic, it's supposed to make you more comfortable, more powerful, and feel like you're riding with less effort.
Yeah. I'm still going to get to that nutrition question, but this was, I think I pronounced it Madhu. Mm-hmm. He or she said, I'm starting to the couch to 70.3 training plan that they purchased on Training Peaks. The last I looked, Melinda, Wendy, I think you have 31. We have 31 plans on Training Peaks. That's what it looked 31. The question is, how do I measure progress in this couch to 70.3 plan? How do I measure progress?
Yeah, I thought this is a good question I wanted to talk about on the podcast because me and Madhu talked. He took advantage of the free consultation. That's what we offer when you buy one of our plans. And we talked about a little bit about his swimming because I offer a free swim analysis to anyone. So we talked about that. And then we talked about, he asked me, how do you measure progress? And he had not started the plan yet. And so, you know, I assured him, you know, there's various ways you can measure progress. Number one, let's talk about metrics. You can measure progress by using your metrics. You do some baseline testing, which is what we have actually in his program. We do the baseline testing in week 4. So you can do it purely by metrics, measuring your pace, your heart rate, your power, your distance 1 week, and then measure that again during the same test protocol 8 weeks later to see how the numbers have changed. Hopefully your pace has gotten faster, your power has gotten higher, your RPE has gotten less at a faster pace. Also, I also wanted to mention measuring progress non-metric related could be, you know, you're starting this training plan. Maybe because you're starting a new training plan, you're starting to eat better. You're starting to eat more nutrient dense foods. That's definitely, you've made some progress towards your health goals, or you're getting massage, or you're starting to do more of the recovery protocols that we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, and you're taking care of your body. That's also a way that I'd say an athlete has made progress by making these healthier choices in their lifestyle now than they did before. Maybe the first week you can only swim a 50 meters without stopping and gasping for air. And then on week 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you're able to swim a 1K continuously at a very low rate of perceived effort, and you could keep swimming. That's a way to measure progress. Or your 1K that you did on week 1, now in week 4 is feeling easier, even though you may be at the same pace, it's feeling easier. That's progress. And so we just talked about just different ways that he could be holding himself accountable about how he's progressing. And in the end, you know, you're going from never doing a triathlon, in his case, to finishing a 70.3 24 weeks later. That's major progress, going from 0 to 70.3 in 24 weeks.
We're going to finish off with that nutrition question I keep on mentioning, but you touched on a free consultation. Can you expand a little bit about what we offer when someone buys one of our training plans on Training Peaks?
Yes. Yeah, so I want to make sure everyone knows what's going on and understands the layout and is just a little bit more educated. So if anyone buys our plan on Training Peaks, we can set up a time to either Skype, talk on the phone, do a Zoom call, and just to answer all your questions, you know, either before you're doing it, maybe you're in the middle of the program, maybe you don't understand what's going on, or maybe you missed a couple weeks and you're not sure how to get back on track, or there's some sort of training lingo that you don't quite get, or, you know, for whatever reason, if you want to set up a time to chat with me, then you can contact me through email and we can set up a time to chat.
Okay.
We used to record it and then put it on the podcast, but that was a few years ago.
And this is included. I mean, it's no extra charge. There's no, upgrade for the consultation, which other coaches or other programs do. It's included. So, extra bonus there.
Yeah, I think everyone should take advantage of that, because then it helps. I like to educate people. It helps me get to know, again, during our plans, what's working, what's not, and then I could make updates. Because if someone, I get a lot, someone might email me and say, I don't understand what this means. So then I know, okay, three people have emailed me, they don't understand what that means, then it's something on my end that I have to go in the program and go and change. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a mutual beneficial consultation.
Last question, again, on nutrition. So we talked about the sprint and Olympic when we were talking about the tips and tricks. From David, in an Olympic distance race, I can fuel with quick sugar packets, Gatorade, noon tablets, fruit purees, but with the longer races, do we have full meals? For example, do I eat peanut butter sandwiches for these longer? I'm assuming he's asking for 70.3s or a full distance Ironman. So do we have fuller, more meals or bigger meals on those races? How do we fuel?
Right. So I think that's a great question. I followed up with David. Number one, I want to mention again, whatever you plan to fuel with in a 70.3 or 140.6 iron distance, make sure you practice it in training. I mean, for after all, the training is to prepare you as best you can, so you know exactly what's going to happen on race day. Number two, yes, you can fuel with what I'm going to call real food, such as meals, a peanut butter banana sandwich, bagel and peanut butter is usually what I like to do. Some people, well, I also want to point out that if you do have special fueling needs, you are allowed a special needs bag and you can pick that up at usually halfway on the bike and halfway on the run. So a lot of times people will put their special needs for fueling in their special needs bag. Like for me, specifically my most recent Ironman in Florida, I had a bagel and peanut butter that I was so looking forward to, because that's not something I definitely don't want to carry that on my body. And I got that and I had a cookie in my bag and I grabbed the sandwich and I was eating it and I grabbed my cookie and I stuffed it up my shorts. And so I had, like, to me, that's real food. It's not the gels. It's not the sugars. It's real food. It's like a meal. Mm-hmm. And I also had practiced training with that. Mm. So I also want to note, with you want to have a lot of different options, because one year I had been fueling with actually jelly beans. This was back on like 2002. I didn't want the sugars that came in a gel. I wanted sugar, but I was fueling with jelly beans. So on the run, after I got off the bike, I picked up this like fanny pack bag of jelly beans that I planned to eat on the run. And by the time I got there, I'm like, I don't want these anymore. I trained with them so much that they were not appetizing. I had no desire to eat them. So I chucked the bag of jelly beans in the trash, and I just relied on the fuel that was offered at the aid stations, which was kind of not necessarily the best plan because you don't really want to try anything new race day, but it worked for me. So if you're planning on fueling with gels during training, note that you might get sick of them. So you don't want to do them all the time, and you want to save them for race day. If you know what works for you, stop using it and just use it for race day. For me, I never train with Gatorade anymore. It works for me. I only use it on race day, and it's really good. I actually want to drink it on race day, but I've been doing it for so long, I don't want to train with it.
Mm. Is there any general principles on how fueling differs based on the distance?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that. It just reminded me that you put on your Endurance Hour YouTube channel, you talked about fueling for a sprint, fueling for an Olympic, fueling for a 70.3, as well as fueling for 140.6, based on directions from Dr. Stacy Swims, who was an expert who actually wrote about the fueling plans in Triathlete Magazine. And so those were very good references to look at to know about how many grams of carbohydrate you need per hour. General rule of thumb, in a half and a full, you're going to range from 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour, and you're not going to need that much for a sprint or an Olympic. For a sprint, you're not going to need much. You want to make sure your muscle glycogen is full before you get to race day, and you might not need anything depending on how long you anticipate being out on the course. So it's definitely how much you eat is definitely related to the distance and how long you're going to be out there, as well as what your body weight is, as well as what you like and dislike. And I think I can't remember if I answered your question.
Just how it differs. I mean, it's pretty simple that the longer you are, longer the distance is, the more calories you're going to need throughout the race. And I guess we kind of touched on it with like what David asked about, hey, I do Gatorade packets, purees for the longer races. Mm-hmm. I need to up my calories. Can I have a peanut butter sandwich? Yes, you can.
Yeah. And I think going back to the peanut butter and what all the nutrition experts are going to tell you, for the longer races, it's good to actually have a little bit of fat and a little bit of protein on the bike to help sustain your energy levels and help sustain your hunger. So when you get to the run, you're not as hungry. You mm-hmm. definitely want to rely on the carbohydrate as the fast fuel, mm-hmm. but taking in some sort of protein or fat, like in peanut butter, is only going to help you as long as you practice it and you know it doesn't give you GI distress. And when you are taking on more of that real food, the meal types of food, make sure you flush it down with water and you're not taking in some dense food and drinking Gatorade at the same time, because then that concentration of carbohydrates a little bit too high and you may have a hard time digesting it and it may just sit in your gut. If you ever have that feeling of your just food is just in your gut and you just want to get it out, start drinking a lot of water to try to flush it out.
One thing I discovered years ago, as we always discover during our training, is that I used to be super hungry post bike ride in training, like a long bike ride. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through advice from coaches and whatnot, I really found out that you never want to be hungry after a race. That means you didn't fuel or after training. That means you weren't fueling correctly on that mm-hmm. during that training. So that's where practice in training can really benefit you on race day. So if I'm hungry, that means I didn't get enough calories. So next time I need to be to where I'm still ready to go after the bike, because you have a run to do in a real mm-hmm. in a race. So if you are hungry, you're not fueling correctly. So don't push yourself just so you can keep on going. How hardcore can I get? No, be smart in the training, because that's going to be the reality on race day.
Exactly. I used to feel like I was bonking back again. This is back in the 90s when I started, and I was really dehydrated. Mm-hmm. Like I would come home, I would go on a 3-hour ride, take two water bottles, and I would drink half a water bottle in 3 hours in Colorado heat. And I would just feel like exhausted, like I was bonked, but it was mostly, I was just dehydrated. And so there's a lot of, a lot of things that can happen in training that are good learning experiences.
Totally.
And so, you know, keep notes, keep a nice log, keep your fueling strategy within your training log. And so you can see, today I did a 4-hour ride. This is generally what my nutrition plan was, how frequently I did it, what I did, how much. And if it works, replicate it in the future 4-hour ride. If it didn't work, make some tweaks, make some changes, consult with a registered dietitian or a coach. Send us an email and see, you know, kind of what recommendations we have to help you change your nutrition plan.
I noticed this in the most recent newsletter that you can sign up for on theendurancehour.com. And then I posted it within our Facebook T2 Endurance group on Facebook, as well as the Endurance Hour Facebook and Wendy's T2 Coaching Facebook, about the new discount codes that you had available for Blue 70. You don't have to say all the codes, but there are new codes for 2022 that you have in the newsletter.
Yes, and thank you, Sean, who emailed me. He tried to use the 2021 code for the Blue 70, which any new person purchasing on Blue 70 who's never used a code before, they get a 40% off code. And then we have an ongoing 30% off. And Blue 70's wetsuit, they make wetsuit neoprene caps, gloves, booties, wetsuits, as well as other clothing and other swim apparel, swimsuits, caps, goggles, and all that. So it's a pretty big discount. I also have a new Power Stride Power Meter discount code that we've included in the newsletter, as well as some of our ongoing codes that haven't changed. But the big change was definitely the Blue 70 one.
Okay. And that you can get just by, if you're a newsletter subscriber, you'll see it. If you're not, you can go to the website or check on Facebook. We put one of my recent posts as of a couple of days ago that click this link and you can sign up, and then you'll get the most recent codes. And we got codes to a lot of different things too. That's the one way we can give back and the benefit for you of listening and following us.
And, you know, sometimes like codes that I get that I'm not even partnered with, various companies such as Training Peaks. Sometimes Training Peaks offers 50% off their premium Training Peaks account. Mm-hmm. When I get notified of stuff like that, I'll put it in the newsletter, even though I don't have any affiliation or partnership with something like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's always good for other athletes to recognize there's stuff out there. We're just, you know, and we're a good source for them to come to get those types of, you know, random discount offers.
Believe it or not, that's the end of today's podcast, 346, a little longer than planned, but good topics and hopefully helpful things for you you can take advantage of. So whether transition, the cupping, the bike fit issues, the fueling, and so on. Any other final thoughts before we get close up?
No, it's always a fun time answering questions.
Until next time, for Wendy Mader, I'm Dave Erickson. Have a great week of training, racing, and recovery, whether you're using cupping or not. We'll see you next time. Adios.
Adios.